Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 163 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and normally I'd be joined by Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog, David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog, and also Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog. But as we sometimes do when we have a major holiday here in the U.S., we spend the time with our families and friends. So instead of our usual format, we've got some pre-recorded segments that we've put together for this episode. Coming up, Rob Mark talks with Lewis Smith from FlightOps.com at the recent Regional Airline Pilot Job Fair in Chicago. David Vanderhoof has some interviews from Oshkosh with folks from Sikorsky and GE Aviation, and also with a pilot at the Pax River Show. Peter Johnson talks with past guest John Norris about his new position at APEX, that's the Airline Passenger Experience Association, and also the APEX Expo. David Vanderhoof has his This Week in Aviation History segment. And finally, we have a few previously unreleased outtakes. Okay, let's get started. First, we have Rob Mark speaking with Lewis Smith from FlightOps.com about the hiring outlook for pilots. Lewis was our guest way back in episode 102, and Rob Mark caught up with him at the Regional Airline Pilot Job Fair in Chicago.
Everybody probably remembers after the miracle on the Hudson, someone asked Captain Sullenberger about his career as an airline pilot, and he made quite a note of telling people that he would never recommend an airline career to anybody anymore. Of course, that's gotten quite a bit of publicity lately because lots and lots of people have decided they no longer want to be airline pilots. Well, I spent a little time this last weekend at the FlightOps.com job fair in Chicago. And when you get through listening to this, if you don't want to be an airline pilot at this point in your life, you're crazy. I'm here today at the Chicago Marriott O'Hare, where it's the FlightOps.com Regional Airline Pilot Career Fair. I'm sitting with Lewis Smith, who's the CEO and president of FlightOps.com, a man I've known for just a couple of years. Let's begin by telling us what FlightOps.com is all about.
FlightOps tracks the industry around the world, primarily the pilot hiring job market. We stay on top of any company who hires U.S. pilots. We will contact them. We will ask them for information about their company, what the requirements are, what the pay is, what the benefits, and we try to get them to come to these job fairs in order to recruit pilots as part of our business model.
Well, now, of course, the one we're at today is just for regional pilots. So what's the big emphasis on regional carriers?
It's a whole different sector. You know, the qualification requirements are a lot less. The pay and benefits are a lot less. And this sector, the regional airline sector, are having difficulty getting enough people to apply, and they're all competing for a shrinking pool of pilots in the market. So we structured this just as a way to provide them a way to attract pilots with as low as 200 hours total time.
Lewis, give me a quick rundown on some of the airlines that are here today at the job fair and some of those that might actually be doing some interviewing on the spot.
On the spot interviews, we see ASA, ExpressJet, we see SkyWest. It is not an interview at first, but it could turn into an interview on the spot, and that's what people are looking for, something to accelerate the process, because everything's gone online, and you go online and fill out an application. You can wait 3 weeks waiting to hear from the people who are in charge, but you walk into a job fair, the people who are checking those emails, looking at that database, are right in front of you. You've got 1 minute to convince them that maybe you should go a little further today. I need an interview today, you know.
So sometimes having that 30-second elevator speech all figured out is a good thing, huh?
Yeah, it's a pilot's rendition of speed dating. No guarantees.
But now, of course, we were talking earlier about the changes to the system, and of course, back in 2007, 2008, practically anybody that had a license could get a job, and then the economy tanked, and everything sort of slowed down. But is that going to change soon, do you think?
It is. The crash in the last 10 years was the worst I've ever seen. It was triggered by, you know, high fuel prices. It was triggered by the age 60 rule changing to age 65, and also the airlines removing all the three-man, three-pilot aircraft from the system. Also, obviously, reduction in passenger revenues after 9/11 had a big impact. So those four things really crushed the industry. And so the last 10 have been was the worst. I've been tracking the industry for 37 years, and it was the worst I've ever seen. And now the next 10 are just going to be the opposite. We try to encourage pilots not run their career looking in the rearview mirror. Things have changed, and they're going to change radically. And I spoke in the room earlier to pilots. I told them, you're faced with the best pilot job market in the next 10 years, so don't get cocky, you know.
Dan Robertson from ASA was just saying a few minutes ago that there have been some really ugly publicity about the fact that being an airline pilot's no longer a career for anybody. I'm just curious. Now, you flew for, I don't know, how many years professionally?
I flew 30 years. I started out with an airline called Hughes Air West with Republic and then merged with Northwest. And now I'm retired from an airline called Delta, but I never actually flew for Delta. My retirement ID says Delta Airlines. And so that was one of my first choices when I started back in 1976. So to end up with a Delta ID is kind of interesting, you know.
Do you think that there are people out there that be interested in an airline career if perhaps the industry was putting a different face on what it's like to work there? Or how do you think you're going to attract the people with all those issues of low pay and people with high student loans because of the flight training costs? How do we get past that?
Well, the industry has to reduce the risk involved in making the decision to become a pilot. They have to improve the guarantees you're going to get because if you go to medical school or architect school, usually when you finish, you're a doctor. You have residency, internship. But as a pilot, most of the schools and most of the training, when you graduate, you're not really even guaranteed an interview. So the path from flight school to university to the airlines is sort of disjointed, and they have to fix that. They've got to go to all the major universities because, frankly, when I was hired, it was 80% of the pilots were military, and now it's going to be 80% are civilian, and the industry's not used to that. They're accustomed to this subsidy of military pilots coming out of the military with high flying time, a lot of jet time, and things are changing. So all the airlines are talking about how you create the next generation of aviators, and they still haven't settled on how much money they need to spend, but they will have to spend some money.
This reduction in the number of military pilots that are coming around, that's not something new. We haven't had military pilots coming out in the numbers that we did back in the 60s and 70s for a long time. So what do you think is taking the airline so long to catch on to this?
I think the last 10 years they've been distracted by the worst industry revenues they've ever seen. And the answers that they came up with were baggage fees, which actually do work. You know, the DOT defines a major airline as an airline with a billion or more in revenue, and now Delta's going to have more than $1 billion in baggage fees. So it's time to redefine the criteria, I think, at the DOT.
We talked a little earlier, too, about some of the incentives the airlines are bringing on. And, of course, we talked about American Airlines, which is now going to offer someone a seniority number if they're an American Eagle pilot up to October the 10th of 2011.
I think the details are if you're on the Eagle seniority list by October the 11th or you've started training, I'm not really sure what the details are. But there's a date there that says if you come to work for us, you will be guaranteed a job, a seniority number at American Airlines, the mainline carrier. And they're doing this to compete with the sector among regional airlines to attract as many people as they can out of this shallow pool of pilots who want to work for the regionals. It's a major advantage for Eagle right now to attract people. You'll notice in the job fair, they have two lines of pilots wanting to talk to them. And a lot of it is due to the fact they're offering a guaranteed job at American Airlines.
Yeah, and in fact, as we were talking earlier, number of people you had at some earlier job fairs was less than what you have here today in Chicago. And do you think that the numbers are up because they're seeing some of these incentives from places like American?
Yeah, I do. I think the word's getting out that it's changing. Hard times are over for pilots, and it's time to move and dress up your resume and get the career. And that's why we added regional job fairs in Los Angeles, and we're going to go to Miami. We're going to do one a month except for December, just on the regional sector. The one in New York in October is we'll have 2 days. The Friday will be the major airline day, and Saturday will be the regional airline day.
Continental is doing something, too, are they not, in terms of incentives for people at the regionals?
Well, they're recalling. They're recalling all their furloughs. They're going through almost the whole list of Continental. And they have an agreement with United furloughees that before they hire off the street, they have to offer United pilots a job at Continental Airlines. It's very possible that those two groups will not have their list together before they have to both be hiring off the street. So it's possible you still could be hired by Continental separately because they have a separate contract, separate seniority list, and the same as United.
When you have a company like ASA that contracts for United, Continental, Delta, will those major airlines, do you think, be coming to the ASA people saying, look, we've got the deal that your guys should have, and that, you know, we'd love to have your guys come to work at Delta rather than go to Continental or United.
As a response to American Airlines offering American Eagle pilots a guaranteed job, Delta has guaranteed ASA ExpressJet a guaranteed interview. It's the first stage. We'll see what happens next.
Well, this is really great. And anything else you might want to tell us that we didn't talk about?
No, I enjoy your show. It's called Airplane Geeks, right?
You don't have to be a pilot to be an airplane geek. I mean, you just have to be someone that's kind of always looking up in the sky and almost runs into a traffic light when you're driving because you're looking up instead of straight ahead. That's never happened to you, has it?
No, never.
Oh, glad to hear that. So, Lewis, thank you so much for your time today. And from Chicago, I'm Rob Mark.
David Vanderhoof provided some interviews from AirVenture 2011 at Oshkosh. First is Jonathan Hartman on the Firefly all-electric technology demonstration helicopter from Sikorsky.
Good day, folks. This is David on a soggy Wednesday morning here at Oshkosh, but that doesn't dampen our spirits any. We're sitting in the Sikorsky tent, and we're going to speak with Jonathan Hartman about Sikorsky's latest project, the Firefly. Jonathan, thank you for being on the Airplane Geeks.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
Tell me about the Firefly.
Sure. So Firefly is the all-electric technology demonstration helicopter from Sikorsky Innovations, which is the new research and development arm of Sikorsky Aircraft.
And what makes it special?
So Firefly is, it is one of the first manned electric helicopters that we're aware of, and certainly the first for Sikorsky.
How is it powered?
So the aircraft itself is powered by a 190 horsepower, high-efficiency motor, supported by two battery packs on either side of the aircraft containing lithium-ion battery cells, similar to the kind you'd find in your laptop, a little different.
And how does that hinder the weight or enhance the weight of the aircraft?
So since it's a demonstration helicopter, we're definitely above the empty weight of the aircraft. We're actually pretty close to the max takeoff gross weight of the aircraft without our pilot installed, and we did that for a reason. We took the airframe, we subtracted the pilot weight, and then we added as many batteries as we could to see what kind of performance we could get out of the aircraft.
Surprisingly or not, folks, this is not a Sikorsky airframe that this was built around, is it?
Well, so it is a Sikorsky airframe now. It's a Sikorsky S-300C, which used to be a Schweitzer S-300C, which used to be a Hughes 269A. And we did that for a reason. We wanted to spend as little time as possible getting this aircraft from the drawing board up into flight test. So we chose a safe and reliable platform so we could spend all of our time focusing on the new hard problem, which was how do you integrate an electric drivetrain into a helicopter.
We're looking at the helicopter right now. How's it fly? They're very large boxes on the side of the... Kind of, folks, if you've seen MASH and the side sponsons that they use to carry the wounded, well, imagine very large battery packs in the same position. That's what it looks like.
So, and you're right in that respect. We actually went out, and this aircraft commonly does missions in the agricultural spraying arena, and you put two large tanks on either side for agricultural spraying. So what we did was take that performance, weight, and CG and put it into battery packs instead. So the aircraft still looks, feels, and flies like a heavier 300.
What's the endurance with the batteries?
Depending on your flight profile, we're estimating between 5 and 15 minutes of flight.
Not much of a jaunt, is it? Although the Bell 47s here at Oshkosh do about a same a distant flight, but for the tourists. When is it scheduled to fly?
So the aircraft is scheduled to fly as soon as we complete all of our key performance parameters in our bench tests and ground tests. We're nearing the end of our full system bench tests, and we're moving towards ground test. Firefly is a demonstrator. It's not a commercial product, but what we really feel is that it's a stepping stone to a commercially viable electric helicopter. In the same way that Sikorsky doesn't make the engines or the fuel systems that go into our aircraft, we're under no illusions that we're going to make the motor or the energy storage system that goes into a future electrically powered machine. What we did with Firefly was try and get out ahead of the curve, learn about the integration challenges that may arise, and get as much ground and flight test data as possible to back up our theories and assumptions.
Tell me about charging it.
So charging these packs, obviously they're relatively large packs. We use, I won't say standard wall power, but a standard high voltage outlet, and these packs will charge fully, from fully discharged to fully charged, in right around 6 to 8 hours safely. And we're doing that, they could charge faster. We're doing that charge time in order to increase the life of the packs as much as possible.
So what's the next step after Firefly?
So the next step after Firefly, I think, is to continue to utilize the Firefly aircraft and open up this test article to other technology providers for energy storage solutions. We have an aircraft that has an electric motor on it. We have these easily accessible battery packs. We'd love to see other people come to us with their ideas and have 5 or 6 packs laying on by the aircraft that we can put on any given day and test these new technologies as they come to market and continue to learn about how this technology is evolving.
You mentioned the electric motor. How different is it from the normal propulsion of the helicopter?
So the normal engine in this aircraft is an internal combustion, an HIO, a Lycoming HIO 360. We've replaced that engine, which is a dry weight of 200-ish pounds, with a 152-pound electric motor and digital controller. What we purposefully did is design the motor to match the exact power profile of the Lycoming so that we would not have any integration issues when we put this on the aircraft and wouldn't have to spend time, I'll say, solving those problems that we know how to do, but would take more time and isn't really on our direct path to a first flight of this aircraft.
And the rotor standard also?
Everything on this aircraft except for the motor and the battery packs are exactly standard. We made no changes to the airframe. We used the same structural mounting points for many of our accessory kits to put this new propulsion system on.
Well, I guess it's the future, and it's quiet.
That is one of the things we're verifying. Our anecdotal evidence suggests significant noise reduction. Obviously, since we haven't changed the rotors or the tail rotor, we still have that noise. But we'll be looking into not only the acoustic benefits of electric propulsion, but the vibratory and thermal as well.
And very long extension cords?
Probably not yet.
Well, Jonathan, I really appreciate you taking the time. Firefly is a very cool technology. One last question. I've been asking this to everybody. If I say one word, tell me what you think. Oshkosh.
Innovative.
Very good. Thank you very much for being on the Airplane Geeks.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Next, David talks to Dave Walsh, Program Test Director for the Sikorsky X-2 record-breaking helicopter. This recording first appeared on Playing Crazy Down Under, but it's good and worth repeating for those who didn't hear it.
This is David in the nice and dry Sikorsky tent, standing next to their latest high-speed helicopter. I'm standing next to Dave Walsh. Dave, what was your role in the X-2 program?
Yeah, I was the test director for the development and all of the flight test work that we did on the project, as well as one of the small team of folks that kind of built the whole thing from scratch.
Okay, Dave, if you built it, tell me a little bit more about it. What are we standing next to? It's not a normal helicopter, is it?
No, it is not a normal helicopter. I think if normal helicopters are kind of limited in their forward speed by a couple of aerodynamic reasons that make 150 knots or so kind of the practical upper limit of cruise speed for a normal helicopter. So the X-2 with the two counter-rotating main rotors was Sikorsky's way of kind of solving those aerodynamic issues and allowing the helicopter to go almost twice as fast as a conventional helicopter. And we, in fact, went 252 knots in level flight with this helicopter.
This is a compound helicopter. I believe you have the rotor in the wrong direction.
Yeah, it in fact is not a compound, which would mean it has a wing and all that. It's a pure helicopter, but it has counter-rotating main rotors. So it has an upper main rotor that turns in one direction and a lower main rotor that turns in the opposite direction. So it has the two main rotors, but in fact it's a pure helicopter.
And the tail rotor is not for torque, it's for thrust, correct?
Right, well, no tail rotor on there, which is on a regular helicopter is there to help you counter the main rotor torque and keep the thing pointed straight forward. Because we have two main rotors and they turn in opposite directions, the torque of one cancels the torque of the other and you don't need a tail rotor. So not needing the tail rotor, we put on there what we call the pusher propeller. And that propeller allows you to go fast forward, okay? So if you want to get going up to 200 plus knots, then you increase the pitch on the pusher propeller, and it allows you to go to those high forward speeds. And basically, you fly it like an airplane when you're going fast.
And it's a very clean aerodynamic fuselage. Everything seems to be blended. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, because the secret of going fast is to have minimal drag. So lots of attention to detail to keep the drag on the aircraft as low as absolutely possible.
The X2 program ended.
Well, the aircraft that we're standing by here, the X2, was a technology demonstrator. The idea was to prove out the concept of the counter-rotating main rotors, the pusher propeller, the integral propulsion system. We had several thousand parameters we measure on this aircraft, data that is going to feed future designs. So this aircraft really gathered all that data for us, proved the basic idea, and is now going to be retired, and our focus is totally going to be on the next generation using this concept, which is the S-97 Raider. And we're just starting to build parts for that aircraft today.
Talk to me a little bit about the S-97. What's the role that going to be? Raider, I guess it will be a military helicopter.
Right. The initial application, we think the most promising immediate application would be for a light scout attack type of aircraft for the U.S. Army.
Like the OH-58 class?
It would be a replacement for the OH-58 and the OH-6 Little Birds is kind of the market we're targeting. But to give them a huge step increase in their capability. You know, those air helicopters are 100 knot or less helicopters, okay? We're talking about giving them something that can comfortably cruise above 200 knots, you know, and can do all of the missions that those can do, plus a lot more.
Yeah, but when you start hanging Hellfires and stuff on them, is that going to reduce the drag?
The airplane, you know, is reconfigurable. So if you want to go really fast, and let's say you're inserting 6 special ops troops that can be carried in the back, okay, you can remove those external stores wings and all, and you can have the 220, 230 knot cruise speeds to get those troops in there. If you have a different mission where you need to have the weapons installed, you put the pylons on, and maybe that knocks your cruise speed back down to 200, but still it's 100 knots faster than anything they have today, you know, even with the weapons installed.
You mentioned troops. It'll be a sizable growth?
It's about twice the size of the X2. The X2 is a 6,000-pound helicopter. The Raider's going to be about an 11,000-pound max gross weight helicopter.
Well, Dave, it's a beautiful aircraft, and I'm one of those believers that says if it looks good, it flies good, and this looks fast, and it flies fast. And it is the world record holder now.
It is, like, unofficial. We didn't get the actual NAA folks here to set it officially, but it is way huge step above what the current helicopter records are, which is around 216 knots, and we went 252. So just never set it officially, but sort of the unofficial record holder.
You know you did it, right?
Right. We know we did it by like a long shot. And, you know, even the guys at NAA who do the records and all, you know, they all talk about it as the unofficial record holder and all that. So,
well, Dave, thank you for being on the Airplane Geeks.
Okay, you're welcome.
Now let's hear from Kevin Bredenbeck, Chief Pilot and Director of Flight Operations at Sikorsky.
Again, I'm standing in Sikorsky Innovations tent. I'm here with Kevin Bredenbeck. He is the Chief Test Pilot and the unofficial world record holder for a helicopter flight, and it was in the X2. Kevin, thank you for being on the Airplane Geeks.
Hey, my pleasure to be here today. Glad you were able to stop by and spend some time with us here. So I like that, Airplane Geeks. It's like, that's exactly what this is. This is my first year at Oshkosh. Ever since a kid, I wanted to come to this show, and finally I'm here. And what a better way to be here with, you know, something that we got to fly and the X2. So what we can tell you about the little airplane?
You called it an airplane. Are you allowed to say that?
Oh, damn, shoot. I'm in the midst of all these aircraft, and here's the helicopter. So maybe that might be confusing, but we got a helicopter here. Actually performs better in low-speed maneuvering than a typical helicopter without that tail rotor. We got a lot more power going to the main rotor head, which equates to better performance. And I guess the airplane part is... you know, I still need the rotor blades to be spinning to keep flying, but they're making lift. And the faster we go, we don't need as much thrust coming from that main rotor, and we transition it back to the prop. So the airplane part is, here we are, a helicopter up above typical helicopter speeds, approaching those fixed wing speeds, and we have the efficiency exactly from an airplane or a turboprop. Give you an example. 215, 220 knots in an X2 helicopter. We're cruising along, and we have the fuel flows of a turboprop. Up at 250, 260 in this aircraft, same fuel flows, not the equivalent fuel flows of a helicopter, which is a lot higher. So that's what's pretty impressive. Cruising along at speeds above 200 knots in a helicopter with fuel flow efficiencies of turboprops or fixed wings.
Talk to me about the transition. So you're not using, you're using the main rotor on takeoff, and then you're transitioning as you get faster to the thrust rotor?
Right. I can either stay in what I call pure helicopter, fly around, you know, nose it over, pull the collective, accelerate, and then if I decide I want to go faster, there's a little beeper on the collective, and I just start changing the pitch on the prop. The faster I start engaging the prop, I don't need as much thrust from the main rotor, so I lower the collective. And then I bring the nose up, and I start cruising along faster. So instead of my nose being down, going through the air like a helicopter, my nose is up in a trim condition, and I'm just using the prop to push me through the air and the blades to create the lift for me.
How does it handle in banks and turns?
I tell you what, unlike any other helicopter, I'm a Black Hawk guy, and I like manhandling that aircraft, but here I have two advancing blades now. I have no dissymmetry of lift issues, no retreating blade stall, so that equates to more lift on both sides, equates to better maneuverability and more G, and being a rigid rotor helicopter, a lot of control power, a lot of control response. So there's no collective inputs, it's just move the sidearm controller, pull. Move the sidearm controller, pull. It's like an F-18 or an F-16, as I tell some people.
So tell me what it was like to break the record.
Tell you what, it's kind of probably surprising. As a test pilot, your head's down, you're really concentrating on the technical aspects of the flight. And I had like a moment where I really realized what we did is when I looked down at the limited amount of power we were using to get to that speed, it was pretty surprising. I had a little, I think I said in the movie, I said, wow, that was nice. Usually you don't say something like that when, you got Neil Armstrong walking on the moon saying something profound, but here I go, wow, that was nice. I was very surprised at the limited amount of power that we used to get to those speeds, and again, we had plenty of power remaining to go faster. It sunk in probably on the long final back on that Flight 17 of really what the team accomplished. Like I said, you've had your head down so long, I mean, concentrating on every aspect of the flight. Again, safety. You didn't want to blemish the name of Sikorsky Aircraft, having an incident. You didn't want to get too involved and miss some of the points that really you need to be looking at on that program. And, still phenomenal. I mean, I feel really honored and privileged that I got to do this, and I really can't wait till we mature the technology in the next scalable S-97 Raider and we get other folks in there to experience what I did.
One last question. We have a lot of young listeners that are always talking about getting into their careers of aviation. Want to tell me about your career path?
Aviation's been in my blood since a child. I had my father and relatives, you know, the military stories around the dinner table, and, you got to listen. And then my stage of growing up, three TV stations, and the majority of them were filled with the space program. So I was really focused on that. I grew up in Springfield, Massachusetts, under the approach of a Westover Air Force Base. So every day, planes were flying over. And then Springfield, Massachusetts is the home to the Granville brothers and the GB Racers. So I was really, really focused on aviation at that stage in my life. And from there, it just took off. And I knew at an early age that I either wanted to be an astronaut or a test pilot. And just kind of put my head down and kept focused on that endpoint. Little did I realize that I'd be in this position today, and then even further than that, the chief pilot and director of flight ops at Sikorsky. So I call it the Cinderella story, boy from nowhere, getting to, you know, have the ride of his life. And, you know, I get to work with some great people, and I've had some tremendous mentors along the way. So I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for those great folks. I mean, that's truly it. So I'm blessed.
Well, thank you for taking the time. It's one sexy machine, and the joy of your flying it comes out in your conversation. So I really appreciate you taking the time on being on Airplane Geeks.
Hey, my pleasure, and have a great day. And like I said, I'm glad I'm here.
We'll have more interviews by David in a few minutes, but first, in this week's Across the Pond segment, Peter Johnson is joined by a previous Airplane Geeks guest, John Norris. John has changed his role since we last talked to him, and in this segment, we learn about APEX and the APEX Expo. Here's Peter and John.
This is Across the Pond.
Today, I'm joined by a previous Airplane Geeks guest, John Norris. John has changed his role since we last talked to him, and today we'll learn a little bit more about his new role, his new organisation, and the APEX Expo. Following John on his travels has always been a challenge, and today John's joining us from Hamburg. John, welcome to Across the Pond.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to be here.
John, the last time you were on the Airplane Geeks, you were with Airbus. Can you tell us a little bit about your new role?
Yes, I can do. After 25 years working for a number of different airframers, including Airbus, I decided that I wanted to take my industry knowledge and experience and put it to a different use. So back in July, I joined Inc., who've been selected recently by the Airline Passenger Experience Association, or APEX, to produce the association's quarterly magazine and some of their other media. And I've been appointed as executive director and editor-in-chief of that new APEX media platform.
Wow.
Some of the listeners may have come across Inc. before because they publish a wide range of airline in-flight magazines.
Yeah.
Including titles for EasyJet, BMI, Brussels Airlines, Germanwings. They do hemispheres for United and Continental, and many more.
Right.
Moving on to APEX, I don't know how many of the listeners will have heard of APEX, so I'll give the quick elevator pitch. It's a non-profit industry association. We have about 400 members, a combination of some of the world's leading airlines and also suppliers who are committed to providing a world-class airline experience for passengers around the globe. APEX has 8 key areas of focus. So we cover things like cabin interior, connectivity, content, in-flight entertainment, in-flight services, use of mobile technology now, pre- and post-flight services, as well as social media.
So what media formats will you be responsible for delivering?
What we have on the table at the moment is I'm responsible for delivering the quarterly magazine.
Right.
That magazine is also going to be available online in the next few days, not only to members, but to the public as well.
Right.
We're going to go live as well with an iPad application, so people will be able to download magazine for reading on their iPad.
Yeah. Right.
We do a bi-monthly, soon-to-be-weekly industry newsletter, which is an editorial newsletter rather than a kind of news collation. We're going to be doing a daily APEX Expo publication. Come back to about the Expo in a minute. I've just launched in the last month or so an editor's blog. We're also running some associated social media channels on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. So it's certainly keeping me busy.
Can you tell us a little bit about the APEX Expo?
So the APEX Expo is an annual event, and it really is airline passenger experience industry's premier event. It features top-notch sort of education sessions and really gives the latest and greatest sort of comprehensive display of airline-related technologies, products and services. So this year it's going to be held up in Seattle in the Washington State Convention Center, and it's running between the 12th to the 15th of September.
What will you guys be doing up at the show? Right?
The show spans 4 days. The first day is an education event where we're going to be covering a range of topics, including technology standards, various content issues, connectivity, seat and IFE integration, social media, and all of other subjects. The evening of the 12th, which is the first night, the Monday, we will be presenting the Passenger Choice Awards, a way of honouring the best of the best in the airline industry. And interestingly, the nominees and the winners, which are put forward for the Passenger Choice Awards, they're voted for by the airline passengers.
Okay, so they're real awards then?
They really are, yeah. They're real awards. They're vetted by an independent company that is working with us to control and, you know, monitor the voting.
Some of the likely candidates for awards, or would
it's interesting. There really is quite a mix of airlines. So there's those airlines that you would typically expect to see, you know, the large airlines. But there's also some of the new airlines as well. So there are some categories which also feature the airlines with smaller fleets.
Yeah.
There's also regional awards. So for, you know, having the globe split into continents. So there really is quite a big spread. So it's quite interesting to see what comes out of that mix.
After the expo, John, where do you see the role of APEX developing in the future then? I mean, you've talked about some of the media platforms and publications. There's an awful lot going on there.
Well, I think it's interesting to know just a bit of history about APEX. Before September last year, it was formally known as the WAEA, the World Airline Entertainment Association, and it focused predominantly on IFE content and connectivity.
Yeah.
And I think over the last couple of years, the board had recognised that airlines needed to address the airline passenger experience in its entirety, and that that experience covered a wider spectrum of topics than just IFE and content.
Yeah.
So a vote went through the membership, and it was agreed that the association would be rebranded as APEX. And it really is now looking at the complete airline experience from check-in to baggage claim.
Right. Okay.
I think the next step really is that APEX is considering now how it can act in a more adversarial role.
Yeah.
And try and champion some of the key issues which are facing the industry as a whole.
Hmm.
You know, things like the Hang Up Act in the US, which restricts the use of mobile phones on aircraft, and other things such as the recent shortage of various tape formats, which are still used on a significant number of aircraft following the earthquake and tsunami that hit Japan back in March.
John, how can the listeners find out a little bit more about the expo, and where can they find you and your organisation online?
Okay, so listeners can find out about APEX and the APEX Expo online at the APEX website, which is at apex.aero. You can find me on the APEX editor's blog, which is at blog.apex.aero. Or alternatively, you can find me on Twitter at APEX editor and also at Nonny Joris.
Excellent, John. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to join today. Good to talk to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
You can find Peter Johnson on Twitter at Nascot Hornet and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com.
Now returning to David Vanderhoof's interviews, here he is again at Oshkosh with Audrey Schnurr from Marketing Communications at GE Aviation. They talk about GE's use of social media and their presence at Oshkosh.
Folks, this is David at Oshkosh Air Venture 2011. I'm here with Audrey Schnurr. Most people know her as GE Aviation on Twitter. Audrey, thanks for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thanks for having me.
Audrey, tell me a little bit about social media and how you suddenly have become the world-famous GE Aviation Twitter.
Well, there's a lot of people behind the GE Aviation Twitter handle. We all work on content, but really what GE Aviation's position is in social media is that we're using it to create brand new reputation, build relationships, and then also just to manage a reputation in certain times that we need to do that.
How have you been interacting with everybody on Twitter?
It's really just us feeling it out, and we have certain people that we interact with because we see that who they are in the aviation world. So we have a lot of different relationships already with companies, and we took that to finding other bloggers and people who are also into the same sort of aviation world that we are, and being part of that community and just interacting day to day depending on what they say and what we say and what we find interesting, and really just being our brand on social media.
What does a GE brand mean to you?
The GE brand's about approachability. It's about integrity. It's about innovation and technology.
Where do you see the social media role going in the future?
It hasn't really been a role at GE, and you met Ian Grace the other day, and she's really been driving social media at GE, but we came into it at the very beginning, and so we are just building up and driving what everybody else was driving at the same time, really trying new things out and seeing what was working and seeing what wasn't working for our business. And so I see that just expanding, and it's more of everybody's role. It's not going to be the social media role at GE. It's going to be how we use digital tools and use digital media to build those relationships, to get our messages out there, and to just manage our reputation.
What was GE Aviation's presence here at Oshkosh?
We had three different booths. We had the GE Aviation booth, the GE Honda booth, and then the GE booth in the Innovation Center. And so in the Innovation Center, where we're sitting now, we have an advert game that's about making people have fun, talking about aircraft health management. And it's another one of those times where we just tried something new to get our message across and have more fun at Oshkosh, since it's the only time we have an audience that can really do something like that.
Very cool. How excited were you to meet the various people this week?
I'm personally very excited to meet everybody from Twitter. I think you know that, David. But I take extra care to make sure that when I tweet somebody back something, I know who they are. I've not stalked your profiles, but I check out everyone's names, see what they're doing, go to their sites, see who everybody's about, and then that's why I interact with them. I really take the time to read tweets and see if what they're saying is funny and if it's humorous and if it's something that I think is good and something that GE might want to talk about too. So it's great. I was very excited.
Who else was at the innovation booth?
On the marketing digital media side, so to stay in the conversation, besides myself, there's Neil Siddons, who's the marketing communication lead for the systems business. And then Eden Zeke was also in the booth too, and she's our digital marketing person for the GE Aviation business. And also Al Como, he's a digital executive on our team too.
So this whole week when I've been doing interviews, I've been asking one question. It's basically a one word question, and tell me what comes to mind when I say it. The word is Oshkosh.
Osh 11. That's what I think of when I think of Oshkosh. I don't know. Can I have some examples of words used?
Well, a lot of people talk about people, but Osh 11 for you, that's a really good answer, because that's what Oshkosh meant to you this year. Osh 11 to me on this show was huge, because I met a lot of people because of that hashtag who I've never met before.
Right.
So it's as good, if you're in social media like we are, it's as good an answer as any.
I would have never met you. We would never have this conversation.
And tell me, what's your favorite podcast?
Airplane Geeks, PCDU. Which one do you want me to say?
Well, folks, that was indecisive, and I'm not going to pick that because I'll get in trouble with either podcast. Well, Audrey, thank you for so much fun, and thank you for being a huge part of the show, at least for me, because it was really cool. Monday, when I walked in the door and I said, okay, who's the Twitter feed for GE Aviation? And you and Eden both came up to me and went, oh my God, it's DM Vanderhoof. It really made my week. Thank you very much.
You made my week too. It was great meeting you, David.
Finally, at the PAX River Show, David talked with S3B Viking pilot Lieutenant John McElroy, who brought in one of three flying aircraft.
This is David again. I'm standing underneath a Centennial of Naval Aviation S3B Viking. I'm about to talk to Lieutenant John McElroy, who flew it all the way from the West Coast, from Point Magoo. John, thanks for being on the show.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
John, tell me a little bit about the airplane, and then we'll talk a little bit about the paint scheme.
Sure. The S3B Viking, made by Lockheed Martin, is a carrier-based jet ASW aircraft. Came out in the 70s, primarily for hunting Russian submarines. And then around the 80s, it got a significant upgrade in its radar and in some of its capability. And then in the 90s, a lot of the ASW gear was taken out, and it was more for surface search and surface combat and air refueling for the air wing. And now we use them at VX-30 for range clearance and for some flight test.
You made the comment earlier that this is 25% of the worldwide S3 fleet flying, correct?
That's correct. We have three operational S3s at VX-30, and the other one that I know of that's flying is with NASA in Ohio. They use it for icing research. The rest are wrapped up in plastic out in the desert for storage.
We have a lot of people who are interested in careers in aviation. Tell me a little bit about your aviation career, how you came to fly the Viking?
Sure. I wanted to fly since I was 5 years old. I knew I wanted to fly in the Navy, wanted to fly jets off of carriers. So through high school, I started to do the research of what it took to be a naval aviator. Found out I had to go to college, so I took a college technical degree. And after college, I joined the Navy via OCS, although there's various ways to get a commission as an officer. And then you go to flight school, and then depending on how you do in flight school, you can select for jets and out of that, and then I selected for the S3. So it took about, from flight school to getting my wings, about 3 years process. And after that, then you're flying in the fleet, flying off of aircraft carriers.
Very cool. And how many hours do you have on the Viking?
I have about 1,000 hours in the S3, about 1,300 hours total. And I hope to get a lot more this year.
How many hours a month are you flying for VX-30?
Right now, we're flying maybe about 30 hours a month.
That's still, if you average it out, an hour a day, which is a pretty good career to have.
Yes, it is. We don't get to fly every day, unfortunately, but most of our flights last anywhere from 2 to sometimes 6 hours long.
Well, let's quickly talk about what the aircraft is painted for. This isn't the way you would normally see a Viking. This is the Centennial Naval Aviation. You want to tell me a little bit about what VX-30 chose for their Kona bird?
Sure. VX-30 chose the World War II Battle of Midway paint scheme for this S3. The reason we did that is the S3, being ASW anti-submarine, has its history steeped in the torpedo bombers from World War II, the TBM Avengers, and those type. And so we decided to go with a World War II paint scheme.
Blue-gray over gray for all those modeling geeks like myself. Lieutenant McElroy, thank you very much for being on the show, and hopefully you'll have a really good show, rest of the show at Pax River. We just had the Curtis Pusher have a race with the V-22 Osprey, and I think the Pusher won. Again, thank you for being on the show.
Sure, my pleasure, and fly safe.
And now, once again, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with This Week in Aviation.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 3, Episode number 25, September 4th through the 10th. September 4th, 1936. The Messenger, a Percival Vega Gull, takes off from Abingdon, England, with the destination of New York City. The pilot was Beryl Markham. Markham sets out with the goal of being the first person to fly across the Atlantic westward nonstop. Flying westward is harder than flying east in the northern hemisphere because of the winds. The Messenger began to ice over 20 hours into the flight. Markham had to set down in Nova Scotia. This repeated the flight of Jim Molson, who has the title of the first solo westward Atlantic crossing. Beryl, while not making her goal of flying nonstop to New York City, is credited with being the first woman to fly the Atlantic westward solo. September 6, 1948, the de Havilland DH-108 Swallow becomes the first British aircraft to fly supersonic. The 108 was designed as a testbed for the soon-to-be-in-production Comet airliner. Originally, the Comet was to have swept wings and no horizontal tails. The Swallow used a fuselage of a de Havilland Vampire with swept wings of 45 degrees and a vertical rudder. Three prototypes were completed. The third prototype, Victor Whiskey 120, would be flown by John Derry. The sound barrier was broken in a shallow dive. Derry would not officially be credited with actually breaking the barrier until 3 days later. His instruments were turned off on the 6th, so no official data was recorded. All three de Havilland DH-108s were destroyed during testing, and all three accidents were fatal. The original prototype, Tango Gulf 283, was destroyed in spin testing. Lieutenant Commander George E.C. Genders fell to his death after abandoning the aircraft in an inverted flat spin. Tango Gulf 310 was the most famous of the three. The second aircraft, due to a catastrophic wing spar failure, which caused the wings to fold back onto themselves at high speed. This occurred over the Thames estuary in a public demonstration of the aircraft. The pilot at the time was Jeffrey de Havilland Jr., son of the great aircraft designer. Lastly, Victor Whiskey 120, the third aircraft, was killed Squadron Leader Stuart Muller Rowland. The oxygen system suffocated Muller Rowland, and the crash occurred due to hypoxia. This is a recent example of why we currently don't fly the F-22 Raptors. While successful in some ways, the de Havilland DH-108 program is one of the most tragic in aviation history. September 8, 1912, the Argentine Army forms a flying school at El Palomar, the Escuela de Aviación Militar. The FAA's official aviation anniversary is September 10th. Argentina was the first Latin American nation to form a military air force. El Palomar is still in existence today and is 11 miles west of Buenos Aires. September 9, 1911, Gustav Hamel makes the first Royal Flying Post airmail trip. Hamel flies a Blériot from Hendon to Windsor. The 21-mile flight takes 10 minutes. Hamel also wrote a postcard in flight to commemorate the event. Operation Sky Shield, September 10, 1960. NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, conducts a test of the radar system protecting North American continent from attack by the Soviet Union over the polar ice cap. 8 Vulcan bombers for the Royal Air Force were used to simulate the attack. 4 bombers came from Scotland, the others from Bermuda. A Canadian CF-104B Voodoo was able to successfully shoot down one of the Vulcans. However, 3 of the 4 did make it through their targets on the northbound. The attack from Bermuda was even more devastating, as 3 of the bombers acted as a diversion while the 4th was able to make its target, Washington, D.C. What made this unprecedented, though, was the fact that it shut down all United States airspace from 1 a.m. to 7 a.m. Central Standard Time. No civilian aircraft were allowed to fly at that time. Some 1,000 U.S. flights were affected, stranding 37,000 passengers. Canada canceled 310 flights, with 3,000 passengers affected. Chafe and flares were allowed in the exercise and effectively blinded the radars across North America. First flights that occurred during the week of September 4th through the 10th. September 4th, 1957. The Lockheed C-140 Jetstar. September 7th, 1965. The Bell AH-1 Cobra. September 9th, 1981. The Avro RJ or British Airspace BAE-146. And that's the way it was, September 4th through the 10th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, the Airplane Geeks Historian, signing out.
Okay, thanks, David. Well, that wraps up this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Next week, we'll return to our usual format, and Dan, David, Rob, and I will be joined by an interesting guest. If you'd like to get more of Rob Mark, you can find him at jetwine.com, on Twitter at jetwine. You can find Dan at thingsinthesky.com. And on Twitter, he's Dan Webbage. And you can catch David at his blog, whatjustflewby.com, or on Twitter as DM Vanderhoof. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter at Max Flight. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 163. Even if you get this podcast through iTunes or some other podcatcher, have a look at our site from time to time. The post for this episode has a photo of some true airplane geeks that you may have heard us mention in the past. Be sure to follow airplanegeeks.com on Twitter and Facebook. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast to your mobile phone. You can send us email. The address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
If you want to subscribe to the Airplane Geeks podcast to automatically receive new episodes, you have many options, including iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, and the BlackBerry Podcast Store. And if you are an iTunes user, please consider leaving us a review. Those really help others find us. Opening and closing music is provided by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. And finally, if you'd really like to help us out, go tell your friends about the Airplane Geeks podcast. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
You know, this is the new media age, David. So like with Wikipedia, it doesn't matter what the truth is. It's how many people believe what other people say.
Yes, good point.
Ooh, fair point.
It's Rob's fault.
You mean like believe anything? So the part about me being a stud muffin, that's okay.
No, not that part.
Just want a little part out there for the ladies.
Yeah, we saw that on Wikipedia.
Yeah, yeah, it's Rob Marcus' stud muffin.
If you look up stud muffin, there's a picture of Rob.
Rob, you don't have your own Wikipedia page, do you?
Because we could fix that.
Yeah.
Oh, I could get the domain name robmarcusastudmuffin.com.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Okay. No, but, actually, they already have that.
Yeah.
That's that Ashley Madison it's site.
Already yeah. taken by Rob Mark. Well, that's weird.
Yeah.
Courtney, what you need to do is for Rob, you need to get IHateCleanCrazyDownUnder.au.
No, here's what will happen. We can sell this Rob Mark stud muffin thing. So first, Rob Mark's Mrs. Mark, if you're listening, send any and all pictures you have from Jamaica, and we will evaluate.
We will evaluate.
You know, that's
that was just a disturbing request.
Well, Dan is a seriously disturbed young man. But we were going to
have a prerequisite, wasn't it, for the podcast?
That's true. I mean, Court has a pretty twisted mind. Not to throw Court under the bus.
It's in the job description.
Oh, I'm always under the bus. I live there.
So, do you want a foreword by Max Flight?
Well, I don't want to sound rude, Max, but yeah. I sure don't want one from Dan Webb.
By the way, Rob, I had a couple of quick questions about this.
You cut that out, Max. I was just kidding.
No, please keep it in.
No,
I like it. I like it.
Like it?
Steven said we need more jokes, so we will toss in as a joke. Right. Number one, what is Simba like as an editor?
He's actually he's quite articulate. He's a little tough to work with, though, because if you don't. You know, if you don't tote the line, he kind of barks at you.
Okay. And then secondly, I think Max will agree that obviously the two of us are the ones that made you who you are today. So what percentage of royalties go to us?
Yeah. And what percentage of the royalties go to my wife, who says she's made me into what I am today?
Yeah, I think you better go that direction.
How about if I let you guys kind of battle it out with Nancy and just let me know?
Or more accurately, what percentage of royalties goes to your daughter's college tuition?
How about 100%? No, we have to cut. Got to cut. There's time for history, but no time for you-know-who guys from you-know-where way down under. We'll just have to scratch them this week.
We'll see.
All right. At jetwine.com and, of course, on the Twitter system at Twitter. No. Okay. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Anyway, all right, let's do this over here.
You can find me.
Preface it. No, you got to preface it with first, Gavin, please.
I feel like it's doing that. It's a merger of the travel Buddha and Dan Webb. Yes. It's a meditation.